This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And I met this guy, was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago at this Vortex? Like, what do we call ourselves? Are we Vortex athletes?
Yeah, for sure. Let's go with that. It's better than like an ambassador.
Yeah.
I don't know what else we call ourselves. A bunch of idiots that are somehow working with big companies. That's what we really are. But
and so check this. I thought about you the other day.
Okay.
Last month, my son had wanted to have his birthday party at a golf range. it's called Pin Social. And it's basically two layers of golfing where you can it's long drives, or you can try to chip to some green that they have out there, big giant nets on all side. And I stepped up and my son was like, Dad, how far can you hit it? And I stepped up and I fucking crushed the ball. Like 320, something like that. Dude, I crushed it. I put everything I had into it. And then I stopped. Okay. Then he told all his friends, he's like, oh shit. And so that reminded me of a conversation I had with you where we were standing next to each other and you go, do you golf? And I said, no, I don't. I very rarely golf. And so I went up, I fucking crushed the ball. And you're like, oh, the fuck, you don't golf, you know, like whatever.
Exactly.
But see, I made the mistake then. I should have stopped right there when I crushed the ball, but then I kept golfing and you got to see that I truly do not golf and that I suck at it. And so, but I made that was the mistake I made. I should have just hit the one ball and been done.
It's more fun that way. Even if you miss the next 99, at least you had that one good grip it and rip it moment. Yeah. I don't golf much, but I went the other day with my family, with my brother-in-law, my father-in-law. And like, there's this one hole where they're like, never use your driver. You're going to hit it in this pond. I'm like, but maybe I'll get it up. I didn't, but
yeah.
Got to grip it and rip it.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Okay. So before we start to get it, I don't even know what we're going to talk about today. We've kind of expressed
that
deer hunting is awesome. We love it. It's what we do. We talk about it for a living. You implement like habitat strategies and things like that for people. And we're going to get into that. But if we talk about it the whole time, it just is going to get boring. Right. And so we're going to start the podcast out by me asking you who you are. Who is Brett Smith and what do you do for a living?
I am Brett Smith, owner of Whitetail Land Management Services, the coolest habitat company in the entire world. Mm-hmm. We are so proprietary. We do everything. We're the only guys that do things a certain now. I mean, that's what everybody tries to play this game. Like, we're all just trying to kill big bucks, and that's what I try to help people do. I own a habitat business, Whitetail Land Management Services, travel the country, helping people try and build the best parcel that they can for whatever they purchased, helping them kind of shorten that learning curve. Like, you spent $500,000, $100,000 on a property. Hey, let's get you on the right track so that you don't waste time and money and a lot of money. That's the main thing. Let's just get you on the right track. Food plots, where to plant, how to plant, what to plant, step-by-step information, timber stand improvement. Do we log? Can we make money on this property? Government programs, where to put your tree stands, trail cameras. Sometimes I work with beginners. Sometimes I work with guys who are really dialed in and we're just trying to take it to the next step. But travel around the country, I've been everywhere from Texas to Minnesota to Vermont to Georgia and pretty much everywhere in between. Man, this year I'm burning the candles at both ends. It's exploded, but all over the damn country. So yeah, that's what I do.
Awesome. All right. So I gotta talk shit on you just a little bit.
Dude, okay. You go half at it.
This is like Ricky Bobby when he says, I can say whatever I want because I prefaced it with all due respect.
Yeah.
With all due respect.
With all due respect.
Yeah. Okay. with all due respect,
go ahead.
The biggest deer I've ever found and have chased have lived in the most invasive species, cedar, multiflower rose thickets that you and your crew fucking cut down and get rid of. All right. Okay. Time out. Here we go.
Oh, I'm not that guy. There are guys that come to properties and are like, you need to get rid of all the invasives. Dude, nobody paid me the money that they paid me to come tell them to cut down invasives. They want to know how to kill big buck.
Right.
If it meshes together, yes. There are certain guys, biology-based guys, who go to properties. And I went to a property one time. Quick story. This guy had hundreds of thousands of dollars of timber that needed to be cut. Like, it was too mature. I could see through it for 400 yards.
Yeah.
And one of the most well-known biologists, and I don't mean to be this way, but goes to his property and says, cut down your eastern red cedars. And I said, he didn't tell you about the couple hundred grand here you got standing. That's bad habitat. And we need to open canopy and make some thickets, like create bedding. No. I'm like, so like, if it coincides with a better habitat plan, I'll be the invasive guy, but like, I'm not. That's not what I'm coming in there to tell you to do. Like, cut your multiflora rows. And like, yeah, it helps. I get it. Creates better habitat. But like, dude, the best honeysuckle thickets you've ever seen in your life or some of the biggest Kentucky bucks I've ever hunted lived. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So if it meshes together, I'm that guy. But like, I'm not coming to your property to give you some boring ass list of things to do. Like, if you hired me to kill big bucks, like, we're going to try and mesh all the plans together so that you end up getting what you want. Like, I don't need to turn you into the world's best habitat manager. I'd like to, but like, if that's not your goal, don't feel like I'm going to force that on you. I'm not that guy.
Yeah. So when your clients come to you,
yeah,
do they even give a shit what you're telling them? Because I look at there's some people out there, and I'm not saying all people, they may like nod and smile to what you're saying, but really in their head, all they're thinking about is the first Boone and Crockett they're going to shoot off their property, or if that's even possible.
There's no way that people retain even a quarter of what I say on a visit. Like, honestly, I repeat myself purposefully time and time and time and time again on a visit to drive certain points home. So that at least a couple main points stick with them over the next couple months. Mm-hmm. And then they always got a report to refer back to. So like, I know, not that I'm the world's like biggest whitetail genius, but like, I know a lot of shit goes over people's heads. And that's why you got to put a good report together, give them step-by-step instructions as to how to accomplish things. But I try to just repeat the like main points throughout that visit and say, this is why we're doing it. Does this make sense to you? Because I wouldn't expect anybody to retain that stuff. So if you got a guy that there's other, obviously, I'll call it consultants. I hate that. I sound like a car salesman using that word. But other people that come to properties and they don't write a report, how in the hell could you ever retain everything? Dude, you couldn't. Yeah. No way.
Yeah.
So like, even the most dialed guys, I don't expect people to like retain everything. But so, and it's hard to be inside people's brains. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but I wouldn't think they would.
Yeah. Here's the crazy thing. Okay. I feel like within the last 5 to 7 years, the term habitat management or land consultant or whatever the buzzwords were for these people really got exposed when they had been the guy, they had been the biologist, or, you know, cut down your red cedars, and they cast these blanket statements across these properties. And all of a sudden, guys like you, guys like my buddy John Teeter from Whitetail Landscapes, are like literally saying, wait a second, there's way more to this than what these people are doing. No hate, you know, if you want to go with those guys, go do those guys. But there's so much more that maybe they don't even know, or they've been in a rut so long because it's worked for them so long that now this certain type of habitat management or deer management strategy has been exposed.
I think a lot of guys come in with this prerogative that like they want to come in and just make landscape changes because it's quote unquote like the right thing to do. But in reality, it doesn't always like give you the best hunting results. Mm-hmm. Like, you can be the best biology guide in the world, but if you can't mesh the hunting strategy side of things together, none of it matters.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you right now, some of the best, bedding areas that I have on some of my Missouri properties are eastern red cedar thickets. Well, I mean, what are you going to tell me? Go cut them down? No.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So like, just to like hear something on the internet, even any content that I put out, like, and to take it and apply it to your property, like, they're generalizations. Any content I put out, YouTube videos, like, you got to really either have somebody come to your property or look at it very in depth and say, does this actually fit my scenario? Like, it's not a one size fit all cut Eastern red cedars down everywhere type thing, or whatever it is. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
So you're not wrong.
Yeah. What has been your, like, the reason why you said you're burning the candle at both ends? You're obviously generating a lot of business. What is it about you that people like?
Dude, I try to be a normal person. I try to be people's buddy, but I try to talk to them like we're buddies. Like, I don't try to be, I'm this guy and I know that, and like communicate over their head. Like, there are a lot of concepts that people don't necessarily understand, but when I communicate with people, like, I try to shoot the shit with them. So I think from a communication standpoint, maybe it makes me a little bit more relatable, but also like, something that's been super important in my business is helping people generate income on their properties. And a lot of times that's not like the rich guy or the wealthy guy's like prerogative or goal, but a lot of times that's not the scenario. And he just bought this first 40 or his first 80. And now we need to know how to manage timber. And so it's like, a lot of times it's timber focused for me, how to handle logging sales or other programs and stuff like that. So like, now if you pay a couple $1,000 for me to come out, we're going to take care of that fee most likely through a different avenue. So it's a combination of just trying to be down to earth with people, shoot people straight, not try to talk over their head and act too professional, but there's a line. And then honestly trying to help people generate income so that if you do have me out, like, hopefully you recoup your funds and then some, 10x that or 5x that, whatever, or maybe whatever, just try and help people kind of recoup some of that stuff. So those are the two things I think that have helped things explode over the past 2 years, but especially the last year.
I'm going to guess here, and I'm guessing that you have a younger demographic as far as your clientele than, or maybe not even the landowner himself, but somebody who is influenced by a younger person doing the work on their properties, as opposed to a 65-year-old guy, or if not older, who is maybe used to the old school way of get rid of the invasive species, plant like 4 food plots, and that's it. Right? Is that accurate, or maybe tell me I'm wrong?
You'd be surprised how many older gentlemen actually do bring me out, and kudos to them, because if I'm an older guy, I'd be like, what is this younger guy now? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You'd be surprised how many people are open to learning more, because simply put, like, I've seen even though they're older, and I'm thankful enough to do this for a living, I've seen a lot.
Yeah.
Like, all over. Like, there's not much that surprises me anymore with the hundreds of properties that I've seen. So, like, thankfully, like, kudos to those older guys who are willing to kind of put that to the side, the age side of things, and say, okay, this guy's maybe still seen, even though he's younger than me, things that I haven't seen. But I'd say I get a lot of 35 to 50 year old guys, but there's some 60, 70 year old guys that are sprinkled in there for sure too.
Yeah.
So kudos to those guys.
Okay. All right. I want to get into the habitat stuff here, in a little bit, about like, what would you do type of scenarios.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about, where do mature bucks, big bucks, whatever the buzzword there, where do they live? Because I mentioned to you earlier, like, what I'm used to, I've never hunted on a property in my entire life that in any way, shape, or form has been manicured for deer. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's been agriculture or livestock. And I just so happened to run into, like I said, the multiflower rose patch that's sets up against a cedar thicket that is overgrown pasture from 50 years ago or some shit like that. And that's where the big dogs live.
Yeah.
From your experience going across the entire country, from what you've seen on these properties, where do the big deer or the bucks like to live?
Vantage points.
Okay.
Explain. That's the most simple way to put it. Topography dictates where deer spend time and how they get from point A to point B. Even in places like, I'm in Northeast Wisconsin at this home farm. That's a terrible farm, but it's where we're from. And there's one topographical line on Onyx that runs through my property. They parallel that line to get from point A to point B. So if I build my bedding areas off of that, and before I even buy the property, maybe it lays out well for westerly predominant winds or something. Mm-hmm. Northwest winds we'll plan for, because cold fronts and all these other things that correlate. If all of a sudden I can place a bedding area on that topo line up at the northwest section of my property and put food at the southeast, and that topo line connects, well, guess how they're probably going to get from point A to point B, or how they're going to parallel it. So topography or vantage points absolutely dictate where deer spend a lot of their time, especially your mature bucks.
Yeah. And like, do you see consistency in that from like, let's say like the Driftless region in Wisconsin, lots of terrain in there versus some other state like potentially Texas or Kansas or Nebraska, where you're looking flatter, more flatter. That holds true.
Without a doubt. And that's why I always tell people like that are living in like the flatlands, still turn on your topo features, because that one line, that one 10-foot elevation change for a mile is enough to dictate movement. It really is. Like, it's just the flow of the land. That's how it runs. And so they find themselves either on it or paralleling it on either side of it. Topo features are different throughout the country, but at the end of the day, they still use those topo lines in majority, unless a major food source pulls them a different way or a bedding area pulls them a different way. They use that to get from point A to point B, whether I'm in the flatlands or I'm in bluff country.
Yeah.
So that, like, if I'm in Buffalo County, if you look at Buffalo County on a map, the topography is actually so neat. You can almost see which way a deer is going to, like, if you get him on camera at one point, you can almost pick a pretty good, like, guesstimation as to where he's going to be in a mile if he stays on the same topo line.
Right.
I'm not going to say you can follow a deer for a mile in flatland, but you'll be able to keep up with him or keep up with what he's doing just by paying attention to the topography on a little bit larger scale in a Buffalo County, because the topography is so neat. But yeah, it still dictates how they move, even in flatland.
Yeah. How many years have you been doing this?
This is my 8th year full time.
Eighth year full time, and then part time, how many years?
2.5, 3 years before that. I probably started seriously in 2015, 2014, shadowed some biologists.
Yeah. And what were you doing before that?
Working in sales.
Working in sales
working in sales. I was pretty decent at it. I worked in sales for like a big distributor of like maintenance and repair products and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And like, I was pretty solid at the job, good enough, because I worked on a farm my whole life. So like, I could sell stuff to guys without being a salesman and be like, hey man, this shit's pretty usable. I think you could use it in this application. And guys believe me, cause I could speak to it. So therefore I'd only have to work honestly like 20 hours a week, and I'd meet my quotas, and then time to focus on what I love.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I built what I did too, dude. So
I remember listening to your stuff way back in the day when you and Kenyon were on too. Like, I remember you talking about the cubicle life before you really jumped in and dove into stuff. So dude, it's cool to see what you're doing too. Like, and who would ever thought, like, we're just some dudes.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know.
Followed a passion or hated their other job so much that they decided this was the best route to go.
Dude, right. I'd love to act like a tough guy, but finally one morning I woke up and I was almost like in tears. I'm like, I have the easiest job in the world. I hate it. My wife's like, well, they quit.
Yeah.
I'm like, really? Yeah, just quit. It's fine. Like, okay.
Yeah.
And you put yourself in that like hard scenario. Like, if you have any motivation, like, you're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
You just do.
Yeah.
Not that we're giving life advice here, but if anybody's stuck between that rock and the hard place, just jump. You'll figure it out. You always go back to our shitty job, you know?
Yeah, exactly. The most depressing part of my entire existence in a cubicle was not the actual job itself, but for me, it was the drive to work every morning. So I had to be there at 6 a.m. or I could work whatever hours I wanted to, but I'd like to get there at 6 so I could get out of there at like 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Right.
Yeah.
But I would have to go into a parking ramp, and then I would park on the same level where this skywalk was. And the most depressing part was the bland ass skywalk connection from the parking ramp to my cubicle, where I had to go like into 4 different skywalks, walk these long hallways. And it was just like, the carpet was from like the early 90s, and I don't know why that just made me fucking hate every step I got on that carpet, just a little bit closer and a little bit closer to my cubicle, was just like, oh my God. It's like, it was almost like I was walking to death row.
Yeah. 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 No, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Too.
Just, oh my God. It sucked. But then finally I got this opportunity and I took it, and here I am today, you know.
There you go.
So,
just gotta dive in.
Exactly. Okay. Crazy question here, and this is like a real life question. How many kids you got?
Two
kids. Yeah. How old are they?
Almost 3 and 9, 10 months.
Okay, so you got some youngsters.
Yeah, right? Before 4:30 this morning.
Yep. Yay. But you're traveling the country a lot too, right? This summer, America turns 250 years old, and there's no better way to celebrate than getting outside and exploring this great nation. One way to do that is to rent a camper or RV from Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone over 21 to rent an RV or camper without owning one. With Outdoorsy, you can drive it yourself, tow it, or even have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. With comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance, Outdoorsy gives you the peace of mind you need when on the road. Outdoorsy is even the perfect option for your next out-of-state hunting or fishing trip. Right now, my listeners can have all service fees removed from their bookings in 2026 with code NFC at Outdoorsy.com. That's Outdoorsy.com and use code NFC at checkout to remove your service fees.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk real quick. How much does it suck to be away from your family?
It's terrible. I literally just had a conversation with my wife. She's at work right now, 20 minutes ago, about like, we got to figure things out because this is getting to be, I'm so thankful for the position I'm in. And I'm not sitting here like patting my back, like, look at me. It's exploded and it's everything I've ever dreamed about, prayed for, whatever, call it what you want. But it's come with a lot of extra baggage, just not being home like I want to be. And when you become a parent, you soon realize like that's the most important thing,
100%.
Like, just being part of their lives. And so missing anything, and I'm a little over the top, like I want to be around my kids all the time, even though you definitely sacrifice some of your mental whatever.
Yeah.
But I want to be around my kids a ton. And so like being away, it absolutely puts like a mental stress on you. But like everything, like the business, I ain't gonna lie, it's been super lucrative. It's exploded. So it's like you're stuck between this rock and a hard place as to what the hell to do. And so we're at the point where we're probably going to have to expand. And I know like that's tough because nobody else is going to love my business the way that I do. That's mm-hmm. just how it works. It's hard to delegate, but it's going to have to happen or I'm going to have to figure something else out. But yeah. It's been great from a business standpoint, but it puts a lot of strain for sure. And like grandma's here today watching the kids inside. And so like we have family helping us, but yeah, sucks, man.
Yeah. But here's the thing about the position that you're in, and this is where I would, like, if I was a consumer of yours, and I have a similar connection or like connection to this, but Brett Smith is the owner of the company. People want Brett Smith on their property. So you start to expand and you hire someone who, it doesn't matter how good they are or what their opinions are. They want Brett Smith because Brett Smith is what everybody knows and what everybody has seen, and his ideas created what has been created. How do you plan to like overcome that portion of it?
One, the guys that I bring on have to be super well versed in the states that they go to. That's like one thing I found to be kind of like BS, is like guys offering services in states they've never been to. Mm-hmm. One of the things that motivated me when I started the company is there's this guy who was like, I've serviced 27 states and killed Pope and Young Bucks in 3 states. I'm like, how are you going to go to these other states and tell people how to hunt deer when you never hunted deer there? That's mm-hmm. wild to me. So like one of my young up and coming guys, like he's young and it's going to be tough for people to take him credible, but he knows so much more mm-hmm. than most grown men because he's super passionate about it. But I said to him, hey dude, you got to go to 3 different states and kill 3 bucks before you ever work for me. So you have credibility in those states. Mm-hmm. So if people ask you, have you hunted here even? You can say yes. So it's a combination of like, hey, you got to have like on boots on the ground experience, but also like, we're going to slowly start to build these guys up through our media. So people know their faces, know their names, and can refer back to some of the content they've been in and get to know them before they ever come to a property.
Yeah.
Build the credibility.
Mm-hmm. What's the, as you started this, right? Obviously there was an education standpoint where you had to educate yourself on wildlife, on habitats, on, you know, what works and what doesn't, or, you know, theories of what would work and what wouldn't or whatever. Talk to me a little bit about like the learning curve that you had to go through as a professional habitat manager, whatever buzzword you use, whatever you, yeah. Like, what do you call yourself?
Habitat manager. I hate using the word consultant, but like, yeah. Yeah.
That's what it is. Okay. Yeah. What were some of the biggest learning curves that you had to go through when it came to understanding how whitetails react to habitat change?
If I had to be honest, I made sure I was pretty well versed in the places that I was servicing before I even went there, even at a younger age. Like, the last thing I wanted to do was look like a freaking idiot pulling up and like not being able to identify something or recognize something. That was one of my biggest fears. Every year you still learn a little bit more. I feel like I'm starting to plateau just because I've seen so much at this point, but like it's a constant learning curve. To say that I know it all anywhere would be a misstatement. Like, if I'm not willing to learn, I'm definitely just, I don't know, I'm not being the best that I can be. I guess it just, the biggest learning curve, man, I don't even know how to answer that, because a lot of my staples that I learned early on, I learned them from maybe other habitat managers, biologists, and then I like tested those theories. Like, okay, do we truly need 10% of the food on the property? Oh, maybe we need more in this situation. Maybe we need less. Is hinge cutting truly the best? Okay, let's actually test the theory. Like, instead of listening to somebody say it on the internet, let's actually try it on this property. Did it work better or did logging suffice? Because then we got to make money. Why not do that? So it's like those things where we hear so much on the internet, and it's one thing to just take those strategies, even for myself as I was learning, and just apply them and tell people to do them. But unless you've actually applied them to a property and seen how they actually affect properties, you don't know. And so you actually have to apply a lot of this stuff. So there's been learning curves through those things, like the things that you hear somebody say, like cut all your eastern red cedars, and then I'm thinking, I'm like, well, I didn't cut them on this property and it works pretty well. It's just applying a lot of those concepts and testing a lot of these theories. Dukebox really bet on leeward ridges. Let's go see, instead of just doing it. Constantly, there's always little topics that you're testing the theory yourself, and I don't think very many people, even from a hunting standpoint, test the theory. They just say, well, Dan Infault said so that's how I hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, test the theory. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's right or wrong. Or Grant Wood said to cut all eastern red cedars. Well, try not to and see what happens.
Yeah.
I've always just wanted to test the theories and maybe prove somebody wrong so that I could be the first to say, hey, let's do it this way. Maybe a little egotistical, but nonetheless, like, still just always testing the theories, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Talk to me a little bit about the biggest habitat mistake that you've made on a property where, I don't know, you walked in, you put a plan together, and it was like, fuck, dude, I should not have done that. Have you had a moment like that?
Well, there's two I can think of. One on my own personal property, and then, not that it was a screw up, but like midway through my career, I went to this property that was like really tough,
mm-hmm.
like just really tough, like underwater. What are we going to do tough?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I shouldn't have maybe even taken the job. But now that I'm a little bit later on in my career, I'm like, oh, we could have done this. We could have done that. We could have done some things differently. So like, this guy owned like a big cedar swamp in the Northwoods, and our cedar swamps are different than your eastern red cedar thickets down in Iowa and Kansas and Missouri and all these other places. Like, ours are underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him to cut a lot of that stuff out and open up canopy. But what we should have done is we should have incorporated some other browse features and some other things that deer truly like that can grow better in wetlands. So that deer actually wanted to spend time down in these water ridden areas. It was never going to be great. It was never going to be good.
Yeah.
But like that one that haunts me, because I could have done a little bit better if I would have known more at the time.
Yeah.
Now, personally, I screwed up on a logging project that costed me six figures on one of my personal properties. Now, I still think I did it pretty strategically, where I could have done it maybe a little bit better. But monetarily wise, like, I absolutely lost like a shitload of money by handling the logging procedure or logging process the wrong way. And that was a really big screw up, but it was a learning and teaching moment. So now my clients don't have to go through that stuff.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you this. I don't know anything about forestry. I don't know anything about logging.
Yeah.
But I hunt the farm that I've hunted for the longest period of my life. It's been like 20 years now. 2000 and next year will be 20 years on this farm. And throughout the years, it's held good, like really good deer, right? River bottom ground that bleeds up to ag, you know, it's got some big timber in it, shit like that. The farmer allowed a logging crew, or the landowner allowed a logging crew to come through. And dude, I don't know anything about it. Obviously there's going to be some kind of impact or tractor ruts and shit like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm just looking at it from a guy who doesn't know shit. Looks like they did something wrong in there, whether it was, you know, like not removing enough trees or removing too many trees or shit like that in different parts of the farm. what's the difference between what you do and what like a logging company would do to a property?
I'm cutting strategically based off of the topographical areas or the areas in which deer want to be, and I'm trying to improve them by opening canopy in strategic ways or cutting a little bit heavier in those areas so that deer want to spend more time there. Like, they just go in and they do diameter cuts or they take whatever's valuable. And a lot of times, like, it looks like shit after. It looks terrible.
Yeah.
And so the biggest screw up that people make is they don't put stuff in a contract to say, hey, all my trails need to be manicured and maintained once you're done. Mm-hmm. Like, all these things, you got to realize you're the one with the resource when you're the property owner. You tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't feel super confident doing that because they just don't know enough about logging or how the procedure works. So, like, that is their responsibility to go in and fix these things. But if you don't put in a contract, it ain't happening.
Yeah.
And then there should be like a performance bond even that's held until the end. And you get to go out there and walk the property and say, hey, this isn't up to my standard. Go ahead and fix this before you get your performance bond.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So I mean, from the difference between me and a logger is, like, I'm doing it strategically for whitetail habitat. I'm thinking about predominant winds, what thermals are doing on this slope. Why would that buck want to be there? Can we make him be there more often? Let's put our food over here. A logger's like dollar signs. You don't give a damn about whitetail habitat.
Yeah.
That'd be different.
Okay. All right. So I got bit. I was drinking coffee outside this morning. I got bit on the neck by a bug. Okay. And now it itches and it sucks. Like, you're outside in this shit, like, especially in the springtime and the summer. I've been just checking trail cameras this time of year and have been overwhelmed to the point where I thought I was going to have to jump in a river or a pond to get rid of the bugs. Like, to just get a moment without them. Like, how bad is it out there this time of year?
Yeah, yesterday I got tore up. Like, I specifically only stay in the north this time of year. Like, I start down south in the cold months, mm-hmm. and then I work up north for the most part. But even yesterday, like, the mosquitoes up here would just carry you away. So here I am. I literally wear overalls now when I go out to properties, and, like, I'm tucking everything in. They don't breathe. Like, they're terrible. Like, I'm sweating my ass off, but, like, I've coated them with 19 layers of permethrin. So, like, cancer is imminent. Like, it's coming. But at least I didn't get bit by bug. And, like, dude, I'll buy some of these bug-proof, like, I think Sitka has one, like, a mosquito-proof shirt, which kind of half-ass works. It doesn't actually work that well.
Yeah.
And then, like, I'll have, like, bug spray on everywhere. Like, yeah, I'm just going to die of cancer from all these chemicals and carcinogens I'm putting on my body, but at least I'm not getting carried away by the bugs.
Right.
Because I'm a freak about it. Like, Lyme's disease almost killed me one time, put me in the hospital at one point. I couldn't even speak.
No shit.
And so, yeah. So, like, I'm deathly afraid of it. Scarred me for life. So, like, yeah, I'll just take the cancer from the bug sprays now and just load up on that.
Okay. So you got to walk us through that. That's not something you just breeze over. Yeah, I was hospitalized from Lyme disease. Cool. Tell, like, what happened? Obviously you got bit by a tick, but.
Yeah. Numerous times I went to the hospital, and basically the first time I just felt terrible. Like, the world's worst flu, body was aching. And I was like, and I'm a younger dude at this time. Like, you know, and I just felt terrible. I was at home with my parents, actually, and my mom's probably working the late night shift. And I tell my dad, I'm like, Dad, something's wrong. We got to go to the hospital. They take me into the ER and they take my clothes off me. I'm like, how long have you had this rash? I was like, what rash? And normally at the point of infection, you get the bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
The bullseye's all over my body.
Yeah.
All over. And so they're like, well, how long have you had this? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I just got the rash, I guess. I just noticed it. And they said, we're going to test you. And at least at the time with the science that they had, they're like, if we test you and it comes back positive on this test, you had it for months. Okay. Came back positive. Then I had lingering issues just from everything to, man, I don't know, just feeling terrible. Like, flu-like symptoms, aching. You get on the doxycycline, it wrecks your stomach. Like, it's terrible for you. And I have long-term issues I deal with from being on it so many times. So, like, that's, I'm not giving medical advice, but maybe that's not the route either. And so finally, like, in college, one time we're at my now wife's track meet, and all of a sudden I'm starting to lose my vision and my hands are going numb, and all of a sudden I can't really see. And thankfully my in-laws were there watching their daughter, my wife, girlfriend at the time. And I said, can you guys take me to the hospital? Like, something's going on. And I remember getting to the hospital and I can't really see. I start throwing up everywhere. And, like, it's on a floor, first floor level. And so I can see out the window to the parking lot. And my girlfriend, now wife, I see walking in. And I try to communicate to her when she gets in, and I can't speak. I'm trapped in my own mind.
Holy
like,
shit.
I know the words I want to say. I can't say them. It's like, the horror movies where you're in a surgery, but you can't move. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm paralyzed. And they're like trying to put me in an MRI machine and I'm throwing up everywhere. And then all of a sudden, whatever they gave, oh, I know what they gave me. For a pain med, they gave me Dilaudid, which I felt it creeping through my veins. Mm-hmm. And I could feel it happening. Yep. And that's one of the stronger pain meds you can get, I think. Yep. And then all of a sudden, like everything kind of subsided, and being a younger guy, like I never asked, why did that happen? What's the plan moving forward? Mm-hmm. I went home, I got a medical bill and life went on.
Yeah.
And so I never really got an answer with that. And finally I remember asking my doctor, family doctor one day after numerous visits and dealing with issues. And like, I hate to be this guy, but like the anxiety, depression stuff. And I'm not that guy. Like I am not that guy. Like figure it out.
Yeah.
But it's happening to me and it's like uncontrollable. And I go into the doctor, I'm like, are we ever going to figure this out? And he's like, I'm not going to shoot you. I'm going to shoot you straight. Like we're just shooting from the hip here. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so it's still to this day, a constant thing that I deal with. And I'm actually flying to Texas to do some pretty wild stuff in the next couple weeks. Like basically, I know it sounds crazy, but get all the blood filtered out of my body, remove all the toxins, stuff like that. And a bunch of other stuff. So like, it's been a constant battle I still deal with, but people got it worse. You know what I'm saying? But that's a short story.
That's bananas, dude.
It is, but I've lived through it. So it's like, oh, it's just what happened. It's just normal. I don't know.
Yeah.
And so, there was like times where I lost my memory in my 20s. And I remember just bawling to my probably maybe fiance or girlfriend at the time, now wife. And I'm like, I'm this old and this is happening. What's the future hold?
Yeah.
And so, it definitely affected, like it literally affected my brain. Nobody's going to tell me otherwise. And I've done a lot of homeopathic stuff. I've done the doctor stuff. It didn't really help. I go every couple of weeks for IVs now. And so it's something I deal with. But guess what? Like, you know what I really look at it as? It was an opportunity to overcome some shit, make me a little bit tougher, and put me in the position I am in today. Because if I look at it any other way and play this poor me bullshit game, there's no sense of living life that way.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I look at it. And not that I'm some big tough guy. I deal with a lot of shit still to this day. But yeah, that's the story.
Unique perspective. My friend, that's crazy. Yeah, I know a lot of people who something happens to them in this world and they tuck tail and curl up and they won't, they just fucking sit there and they're just like, you still have a lot of life left you could live. Oh, but I have this and my whatever and shit like that. It's like, for example, I was talking to a physical therapist. And he said to me, hey, dude, you're not the youngest guy with a total knee replacement anymore, right? And I go, are you serious? Right? Like, how old is this? This guy's 2 years younger than me, 43, he got one. And I was like, I mean, is he like me? Is he active? Does he have kids and shit like that? He's like, he's not very active, but he's back here with us because he had one and then didn't do anything, just fucking gave up. And I'm like, I can't do that. Right. Like, I don't know. Like I'd want to kill myself or some shit like that. If I gave up and just whatever. And so, yeah, dude, I feel you. How many, like, this is the surprising part, the amount of times or the time period that I've spent in the woods over my entire life, especially during quote unquote tick season. Right. I've had ticks on my body. I've been bitten and shit like that. What blows my mind is how some people will get that and guys like me still, and maybe I have it and maybe it didn't affect me. I don't know, but still have never been impacted by something like that.
That's the thing that drives me nuts. And it makes me feel like the biggest baby sometimes. Like clearly I had real symptoms, real things happen.
Yeah.
I'm like, how the hell do people like just test for Lyme disease after 20 years? And they're like, yeah, I had it. I'm like, why did it affect me like that?
Yeah.
Am I being a pansy about it? And like, okay, when you can't speak, like clearly something bad happened.
Yeah, something.
You know? But it just pisses me off because like some people will be like, oh, I don't know. I've just been living my life like this. And it's the dude that's like ripping a pack of cigs and a 12 pack crying, you know, and I'm out here taking care of my body, flying across the country to filter my blood. Like,
yeah, like, exactly.
For me. Like,
that's hilarious.
But you got to do what you got to do with the cards you're dealt, man. Every time some bad shit happens to you, all I look at it as right now is an opportunity to overcome it. Because every time you do, you're just climbing up those rungs. Like you're building yourself mentally a little bit tougher. And that's a combination of just growing up that way. Parents worked in mills and factories and stuff like that and kind of raised me that way. Just put your head down and work.
Yep.
And we had a pretty decent sports career. And so it's like, hey, I got there because I worked hard. I was naturally good at stuff, but like had to work at it. And so that's my mentality with life. And I don't want to be one of these big motivational guys, but like, I sure as hell ain't gonna just crawl in a corner. Every time something bad happens to me, I have this little psychotic guy in the on my shoulder. It's like, good. Like now overcome it. See what you can do with it. And I think that's probably why I'm thankfully, and there's a lot of other variables, but in the position that I'm in today is kind of having that mentality. And now, shit, I'm in the outdoor industry, getting paid by companies, making a living, and hopefully retiring my wife soon. Like, it's paid off, but you just got to tough shit out sometimes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a fact, my friend. That's a fact. Yeah. What's the time frame here as far as the scope in which you work? Is it from December to July, or because at some point people don't want you on their properties. They want to hunt, or you want to hunt, or some shit like that. So do all your work in 10 months, or what's the deal?
Yeah, it used to be like December to pretty much May, or it started to be April, then it climbed into May, and now it's just going to keep going, and people don't want me to come out to the property anymore. And a lot of times people would be like, can you really tell what's going on in the timber when it's super thick and dense? And I'll be honest with you, back in the day, I would say, no, I can't do it. Now, I have a lot of these properties figured out before I ever set foot on them, and now it's confirmation just based off of topographical flow, looking at the size of the diameter of the trees, or excuse me, the canopy, by looking at these like aerial maps. Like, I have a lot of that stuff figured out, and I can walk on a property, and a lot of times, I know it sounds egotistical, but I can walk on a property and say, within about 75 yards, we're going to see some condensed sign, maybe 6 to 12 rubs in an area. There's most likely like some buck bedding taking place here, and that's when like I get it, like these certain topo features that are just like, oh, like he's here. We've seen the puzzle pieces. I'll predict it before we ever get to it, and we see it. Like now I can do those things where I used to not be able to. So therefore, like now if people are calling to it, and even from a business standpoint, I ain't gonna lie to you, somebody wants to call me and pay me to come out, like we're doing it all the way through the summer now. So it'll hopefully stop in July this year, but people keep calling, man. That's the reality of it. So yeah, I'm not gonna sit here and turn down business, but we got to start putting people on the calendar for next year too.
That's crazy, man. That's crazy. Yeah. Especially when you, like, you're so good, and I don't want to say I'm that good at deer hunting,
yes.
You know what I mean? But
yes,
when you can walk onto a ridge and you go, dude, this trail's here for a reason. I bet you if I follow this up here to this thicker area, I'm going to find some beds. I'll find some rubs. It's going to be a staging area up to this ag field. And, you know, I bet you there's more activity here on a south wind with, you know, a dropping thermal or with a rising thermal or what all this shit is. And it just clicks for you. And then you become like Neo from the Matrix and the deer just come to you. And
well, but if that, the same way, like I guess from my perspective, like there's an algorithm that's been built from seeing so many properties. Like I've seen this before. Yeah. Watch this.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, like I can predict that stuff now. And honestly, like poor me, it kind of ruined deer hunting, because when you can start predicting stuff before you've ever even been to a spot, like on a property ever, and it's like, well, shit, figured it out. First scrape outside the bedrooms right here. We need to monitor this scrape. Oh, look, there's 6 to 12 condensed rubs right there.
Yeah.
Common sense would tell me he beds here on a northwest wind, monitor it, confirm it, kill him.
Yeah.
And so it's turning into a video game with all the technology we have, and we could talk about that stuff too. But like, thankfully, I've been enough people have hired me to go to properties where keep learning. I've seen most, like, you're not going to surprise me with much anymore. So now I have this mental algorithm, I'll call it.
Does that ever, like, it's probably cool to step on a new property every single day and see something a little bit different every single day. But how do you stop from being like, I don't know, maybe it's because, let's see, I'm trying to think of when I do this. I've been humbled a lot when it comes to deer hunting, but I also know that if I play my cards right, I'm going to get a shot at a mature buck every single season since 2016, when I started to figure it out, right? Like, it's clicked for me. I know what I'm doing. When you walk on a property, do you ever just like, I'm going to fucking crush this? Like, I'm going to crush this property. And the reason is because it's a blank canvas and I have the knowledge where I'm going to blow this fucking dude's socks off because I'm going to make it so much better than what it is.
And whether he did it on purpose, did it on accident, sometimes they buy the one with the perfect bones, the perfect axis, but they don't know any better. And it's like, sit back and enjoy the ride. And I think those are easy. And like, I have preliminary maps I've done, and I'm like, I hope it lays out like this. 95% of the time it does. And like, they think I'm bullshitting them, and they probably think I do it to every property owner. But I'm like, hey, man, I'm personally excited for your property. And here's why. I'm not just saying that because I'm here today. Like, you got some bare bones that we're going to be able to turn this place into something special. And let's go out today and confirm it, build this property. And yeah, so that happens sometimes. And some people got shit. Some people have shitty properties too.
Yeah.
But I can take your 3 out of 10 and turn it into a 6. You may never be a 10 out of 10. There's never been a property I haven't made better. But yeah, sometimes you get those properties with those 10 out of 10 bare bones layouts. And it's like, oh, watch this. Yeah.
Or some rut funnel that just connects two properties and there's only nocturnal movement. And then you go in and do something and it slows them down or some shit like that. And then it's daylight activity. And the guy probably thinks you're the Messiah. Right.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's a weird concept because then they're texting you and you can feel like the relationship is kind of like, I don't want to be this way. I really don't. But like, you could tell they look at you as somebody and it's like, I guess that's humbling and cool, but also it's kind of like, oh, that's a little weird. Like, I'm just a dude who likes deer. I don't know. But like, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm helping people. So I get it. But yeah, there's always like, there's a handful of guys every year where like, you can really tell, I don't want to say they look up to you because sometimes they're older than you, but like, they really respect what you did for them. That it's cool. It's a weird dynamic to like, feel like you're somebody or, but like, but yeah, I mean, it's cool to help people, man. And when you get a picture of some little girl's first buck or some guy's biggest buck ever, and it's like, holy shit, yeah, what I said worked. And even 800 times in, it's like, it's still shocking that it works.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know, but you put the time in and it's bound to happen.
What impact do neighboring properties have on the plan that you put together for whatever property you've been hired to change?
Yeah, it plays a big role. A lot of times, I'll just give a little quick tip here. A lot of times I will try to lay out my bedding based off of predominant winds on like, let's say a westerly side of the property. Let's say your shitty neighbor's to the west of you. I will put my bedding over there because on 90% of the winds throughout the season, when he enters from his west side, in theory, he's wind bumping all the year deeper into your property. Mm-hmm. 1 out of 5 years, he's going to get one on you. He's going to get lucky. And that's the reality of it. But like, especially on a small parcel, it plays a role when we only have the opportunity to create 1 or 2 bedding areas. We almost got to play the game so that, hey, like when the neighbor comes in, this is going to benefit you instead of just letting the natural movement take place. Like if you got a small property, you don't have that luxury. So we got to take that into account.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so the bedding, right, is obviously that's the example you use there. But is there like, are there times where you walk into a property and you're like, dude, you have a good property, right? The only thing that you're missing is a standing corn plot in December, right? And that's going to hold all the deer and you're going to be able to kill a muzzleloader here because the rest of the neighbors are food deserts at this point. Like, do you ever say like, how do you want it? Do you want it cheap or do you want it expensive? Because I can plant a cornfield for you and keep it up. And that's going to have deer here in, you'll find sheds and you'll kill a late season deer every year.
Yeah. I mean, there's always that pressure to give somebody some big elaborate plan. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not necessary. And I just shoot those guys straight. I was like, I could bullshit you and give you a 30 page plan as to all these small little things that we can do that ain't going to make a difference. But you know what you really need to do? You got to plant that corn. Yeah. You got to put it over here. You got to, and that's semi rare because there's always something to improve or move these stands and move these things around or get 10% of the property in food. But like, yeah, sometimes I go to a property and in the back of your head, you almost feel a little bit of pressure. Like, this guy paid me a lot of money to come here today to give him a 1 or 2 or 3 step plan, even though that's truly what he needs. Like it feels wrong, but I just shoot him straight and say, hey man, I could waste your time and give you 30 tasks. These are the three. Yeah. These are the three things you got to do. And this place goes from a 7 to a 9 just by doing them.
Yeah. Okay. So I ran into a piece of your content after I cut down a whole, like, I don't even want to say a whole bunch of trees, right? So I have this idea. I have this property that runs north-south. The timber runs north-south across a creek that runs north-south. Mm-hmm. And on the west side of this creek is this old black locust and Osage orange cattle pasture that has grown up throughout the course of, you know, however long it's been there, 30 years, 40 years, something like that. And I said, I'm going to create these little bedrooms or these, you know, these thickets where deer are going to feel comfortable because in there right now I can see a long ways, right? The only thing that's stopping me is little bumps in the terrain.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, well, I'm going to cut down some trees or I'm going to try to hinge cut. And the hinge cutting worked, by the way. And it grew up thick, and some of those trees are still alive today. That, you know, they got that lower stem count. It worked awesome. But it's about the size of a basketball, like the paint in a basketball, right? I cut down, I counted 22 trees, and I thought that was going to be significant. And your content that I ran into was, dude, you got to like 10X that shit, right? And cut down way more to have a serious impact. And so I went back there this shed season after I did it the last year, and it's literally the size of this office. Maybe one deer would be able to take advantage of it on a specific wind. You know what I mean? And or maybe the turkey would have a nest in there or something like that. So now after seeing that, why is it important to go bigger on something like that than what people always think?
So in your scenario, you didn't have like timber value, but here's the thing. If we had timber value on a property, you got to hammer it right the first time, because if you half-ass it, nobody's coming back. Right. No logger, that's not monetarily worth it. Mm-hmm. So like that's extremely important to hammer it the first time because nobody's going to come back. Now in your situation, like nothing was lost other than time. You're just going to have to go in and fix it and expand upon it. So like if you're not sure, okay, do some little projects. Like if you can't afford to have a consultant out or somebody that knows what they're doing, like start small. But realize if you can look around and you're like, okay, white oak, walnut, some nice, really straight trees. Maybe it's even popple, whatever it is. And you're like, I feel like this could be valuable. You gotta do it aggressively with the right plan in place. Mm-hmm. Because if you half-ass it, nobody's coming back to fix it when all of a sudden 2 years later, you're like, oh shit, I didn't do enough.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And now you're like, well, what do I do? Do I start cutting down these oak trees? Well, that's kind of monetarily stupid. Like, what do I do now? And so if you feel as if you have timber value, bring somebody in. I don't care if it's me or somebody else that knows timber. Bring somebody in so we can do it right the first time so you get the results faster. Because if you don't do it right the first time, nobody's coming back. It's going to be harder to. And the guy that is coming back isn't very reputable, and he's probably going to screw you over.
Yeah.
But in your scenario, worst thing you lost was time.
Now, what about not necessarily the value or of the tree itself, but the impact on the actual deer, right? Like, I know I didn't do enough. Because I can step back and look at the area that had the grass grow up in it and is now thicker, and it's not that thick. You know, it's just like one little bedroom on a house, as opposed to like the foundation of a house or a person's property or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, why is that? Why is it important for, why would it have been important for me to do 4 or 5 times that and cut down 100 trees? As opposed to 22.
Because maybe just a dinker buck used that one bedroom and now there's nothing left. Like give options. Like if you create enough options, there's even on a small parcel, there's a very realistic scenario. And maybe it's 2 or 3, 4 days out of the year. There's a realistic scenario where multiple bucks can be on your property. If you create one bedroom, it's for one deer or one little group of deer. Yeah. If you give them more options, the chances of you having a bigger buck just goes up, simply put.
Yeah. Okay. But I've also heard you in certain scenarios talk about why hinge cutting might not be a good option for your property. Why would a hinge cut be a bad option for people?
I truly like, and maybe it's because I understand timber. I'm not an expert on timber. I won't say that, but like, it's because most times people have value on their property and they could get paid to open up the canopy. Mm-hmm. So why are you going to cut down these trees? And hinge cut. Now, here's the thing. In phase 2 of our TSI projects, we probably should do some hinge cutting. We should probably do a little bit of girdling. We should probably do those smaller TSI projects to really hone in and put that deer in that quarter acre area after we made our money. It's kind of like water holes. Everybody buys a property and puts a water hole in. Hey, dude, no deer is coming from 400 acres away because you put a water hole in.
Yeah.
I know that's a sexy topic right now, but you got to build the habitat first. Let's create this mass, like big project, timber stand improvement project, make money doing it, and then micromanage with some little hinge cuts. But the reality is people watch content, they get excited, they grab their chainsaw and say, what can I do today?
Yeah.
You can't get a logger out there today. You want to go do something and make a difference. You don't have the patience and you go out there and you cut trees and maybe you lost a little bit of value or made it harder on the logger or whatever, but they did it in reverse order.
All right.
So hinge cutting like is bad when used in the wrong order. There's a time and a place.
Yeah.
But I'll bet you I've only prescribed it for bedding maybe 20 times out of hundreds of properties because we got other shit to do first.
Yeah.
That's the reality of that conversation about hinge cutting.
Okay. All right. Man, there's a lot of bullshit on social media, right?
Yeah, man.
And whether, and you just insert topic and there it is.
Yeah.
What's the shit that people need to really look out for when they, when they're like, hey, I'm scrolling through Instagram. I hear somebody say they're going to do this. Oh, I can do that. I'm going to go in with an axe or, you know, and hack and squirt, or I'm going to go hinge cut, or I'm going to go do this. And then you cringe when you hear that shit, because it could potentially be leading someone down a very wrong path for their property.
I'm probably going to offend somebody because they're the guys that sell these products that generally get worked up about this. But dude, the switchgrass kick drives me nuts. States like Iowa, states like Illinois, there's a time and a place. But the reality is, and I'm not even saying this because I don't like a consultant or I don't like the guys that preach this shit, but like they tell everybody to plant switchgrass. And if I plant it too far north, the snow knocks it over. I don't care how resilient you tell me it is.
Yep.
Snow's going to tip it over, offers nothing later in the season. Even in Illinois, I was in and around Paris, Illinois, and this client has me out. I think he had somebody else out first, which happens often, and not saying I'm better, they're worse. Like, I guarantee other people will go to properties after I've been there because the clients maybe want a different outlook. But anyway, I go to this property and he's like, so-and-so told me to plant 7 acres of switchgrass here. You don't use it. I said, think about it this way. If I plant a monotonous sea of switchgrass, and a deer goes in there and he lays down, he can't see 3 feet in any direction. What keeps a predator from sneaking up on him? There's got to be structure in there. So switchgrass, like by itself, is pretty shitty in a lot of scenarios. And even for screening, I hear people on, oh, create screening with it. There's better screens. So to create like big switchgrass fields and hope for deer to bed in them, it's just not super realistic, especially in big timber country. Now, if I take a plowed field in the middle of nowhere, Iowa, and I put it in switchgrass, so it's the next best thing on the list. So he's going to spend a little bit of time there. Guys in Iowa have absolutely killed giant bucks out of seas of grass. But I mean, the reality of it is that like in these more timbered areas, there's better structure elsewhere for these deer to spend time, and they just don't use those areas like you'd think. So now you spend an ass load of money on switchgrass and you never get the results you wanted. Now you got to treat it with herbicide, and like, it's a process 3 years to get it standing. And then you hit your three and you're like, well, the deer aren't using this.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of switchgrass. Illinois, Iowa, Great Plains-ish area, there's a time and a place for it. The other 90% of the country, there's better options, even for screening.
Yeah. Okay. How often do you run into a client who thinks they know more than you do, where you go in and you're like, here's what I would do, and then they're just like, that's stupid. Why would we do that? They hire you, but then they're in conflict with you.
One guy a year. There's always one a year, and it's kind of, I hate to say this, I'll shoot you straight and be honest. Like, at some point during the visit, I just kind of sit back and just listen, because they just, yeah. I don't want to have an ego, but like, I'm there to teach you not teach me. So like, yeah. Let me speak about my topics. And if we want to converse about them and come up with your ideas and my ideas and mesh them together, we can do that. But like, sometimes they almost want to like show off what they know.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, why am I here? Like, I'm trying to help you.
Yeah.
And you're not letting me because you're telling me about these things you saw on the internet and how you're going to apply them to your property.
Yeah.
And it's just different personality types. Like, you're just going to get people like that. And I'll be the first to admit, like, you're going to get people that don't like what you did with a property. They probably didn't implement anything, but like, they're upset about something. Like, you're always going to have oddball characters, and it's just important to know how to handle those guys. But sometimes on visits, like, I'll do everything I can to help people, but sometimes you just sit back and you're like, I guess I'm going to listen today.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not letting me help you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happens. Maybe once a year.
What's the important, okay. So obviously you do the habitat work and the wildlife like approves of it, right? They come in, they live there. They take advantage of the new browse or the food plots or the bedding or what, all that stuff. Right. But at some point the hunter has to be able to get in there to hunt these animals, whether it's turkey or pheasants or whitetails, right? How important is access in your plan?
Yeah, it's everything. I mean, based off of predominant winds, sometimes you don't get the choice to lay out a property for every single wind. So you pick and choose what you can based off of what's the most predominant or popular, I guess. But I mean, it plays a role in everything.
Yeah.
And you only build properties in most scenarios based off of the access routes and where you can get to. Sometimes you'll have a food plot, you just don't hunt. And that's a crazy concept for some guys. They're like, they have to hunt it. Mm-hmm. And I get it. You put money and time and effort into it. But ultimately, if you maybe leave it alone, that's why the deer spends time there. But like without access, a farm is junk. Yeah. I don't buy farms unless I got multiple access points or at the very least like a good easterly line that I can insert myself in and J-hook into position.
Yeah.
And then we build properties based off of that, what the access allows us to do. So like yesterday I was on a westerly access property and I shot him straight. I was like, this will never be a 10 out of 10 for that reason, but we're going to have to hug the property lines, J-hook back in, back in based off predominant winds. So it plays a huge role.
Yeah. Okay. Talk to me about a property that you worked on that was dog shit when you got there and now it's bad, like badass, dude. And how much time went by from the time that you got there, it was crap, and now it's a primo farm?
There's been so many, they just all blend together sometimes. The first one that comes to mind is like a South Central Missouri guy who had me out, and man, he was killing like 125s at best, honestly, and then implemented a lot of this stuff. And it was basic stuff, at least from my standpoint of, hey, westerly bedding, 10% of the property in food. Let's make sure that our food is palatable during every single step of the season, meaning that we plant something super diverse so that there's a reason for a deer to be here every single step of the season. Implementing that stuff, like that guy was a solid 2 out of 10, but had the bare bones to turn this place into something better because he had good north access and good easterly line access and some different stuff like that. In a farm like that, you can transform from a freaking 2 out of 10 to a 6, 7, or an 8 relatively quickly. And now just a couple of years later, like he's killing the biggest bucks of his life. Now is he killing 200s? No, like not every neighborhood's going to produce those, but he's killing the biggest bucks in his neighborhood and he's doing it on a 60 acre parcel.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, like, it's especially helpful when they have the right bare bones and we can go plug and play some of these different important factors. But like in that given scenario, yeah, just a 60 acre parcel, he was getting bucks on camera, but now he's killing them every single year. And so is his wife, even on a little 60 acre parcel.
That's badass. What about, how does trigger control then, like, how do you talk to people about, okay, I've made your property better, it's going to hold more deer, but if you truly want bigger antler deer, you can't shoot the 3-year-old anymore.
Yeah. So there's, it's like a two-sided plan. Hey, let's do everything we can with the habitat. Let's make it as good as possible. But now here's how we manage the deer. Yeah. And the things that I drill home to people is, hey, shoot does. Like it's our issue. Everywhere I go, like there's a direct correlation to the property owners, even on small parcels. That I see that shoot does, they are also killing 160 to 200 inch deer pretty consistently. Mm-hmm. And so that's the correlation. Say what you want about 1 buck states, 2 buck states. That's the correlation. So doe management, super important. Step number 2, kill bully bucks. I'm guilty of not doing it. Yep. We got iPhone footage of us watching a 7 or 8 year old deer because my trail camera told me there's a 170 running around.
Yeah.
Step number 2, kill bully bucks. And then when you kill that bully buck, Mr. 3-year-old 10 pointer rolls in, let's save that deer.
Yeah.
Let's not shoot that deer. Those are like the 3 steps as far as managing the herd that people need to implement. And I'm not going to make it more complicated than that. If you do that, you're going to have the best caliber deer generally in your neighborhood. If you built the habitat and then manage appropriately and with those factors in mind.
Right. Okay. You mentioned like 1 buck states and there's some of these rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on states like Michigan going to a 1 buck state or potentially now New York? Missouri is thinking about changing its rules and regulations and other states. That seems to be the fad that other states seem to be following. What are your thoughts on that, given your experience with habitat management?
It's a problem. It's not the problem. Will it increase buck quality? Yes. Will it turn these states that are a 2 into a 5? Yes. I'm telling you, dude, killing does is more important. Earn a buck should have been implemented. And I know it's like a hot topic. And how do you manage that? How do you make sure people are killing the does? And I have some ideas, but like killing the does is more important than and doing like an earn a buck would create better results than taking your 2 buck state down to a 1 buck state, I think. How do I know? Where are the biggest deer in the country? Iowa, Ohio, Western Kentucky, I'll say. Portions of Missouri. What portions of the country get smoked with EHD and resets the herd? Does the job the hunters don't want to do anymore? Because, well, here's what we do. We look at our trail camera. big buck. ABC is what I'm shooting this year. Always in the woods, I'm not shooting a doe. Always around, I'm not shooting a doe. We don't manage the herd. We don't spend $10,000 on an acre nowadays to shoot does. So we don't shoot does anymore. Mm. Direct correlation to the places that I go in the country with the biggest bucks that get smoked with EHD. Nature takes care of the problem that we're not taking care of. And that's how I know doe numbers are absolutely the issue. And I know it's not sexy to shoot does, but there's a correlation to the properties I went to this year. They were killing 160 to 200 inch deer on 80 acre parcels, even not 500. The guys that were smoking does, or the farmer next door was smoking does. Somebody is shooting these does. So will two bucks to one buck help? Yes. But that's problem 1B. That's problem 1C. 1A is shooting our does. The issue I have with it, and I know a lot of people don't care about this, it will increase our buck quality. So us diehard hunters like me and you, or maybe some other people in the industry that are more horn hunters, it's going to help our quality. We're the minority.
Yeah,
a lot of guys don't hunt like us. So how does it negatively affect them? Do they fall out of love with hunting? Do they no longer go to their deer hunting camp that was dying anyway? I hear you. But now they like, and then we lose hunters, and then do we lose power? So I know I'm going on a tangent here. There's a lot of different directions to go with this conversation. Those are my issues with some of those changes.
Yeah, I feel you. A lot of good conversation today. I was getting ready this morning. And it was after my morning poop and before my shower. I was scrolling on the internet, and this is, I don't know why I'm bringing this up now, but this lady was talking about, even at the speed of light, the chance of us in from Earth going to the next closest galaxy, which I believe is like 4.4 light years away. So that means at the speed of sound, or at the speed of light, we would have to travel 4 straight years to get to that. Do you think we will ever like live on another planet or live in another galaxy, even like 1,000 years in the future?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, dude. It's evolving way too fast.
Yeah.
I think that, dude, I'm like pretty into like the health stuff.
Yeah.
There's already clinical trials happening to like reverse age. They've done it in mice. They've done it in primates. Mm-hmm. So if we're doing that, my dad always said, like, when I was young, we had horse and buggy. We worked the fields, and now I got a computer in my pocket. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
I have a feeling when I'm 90, I'm going to be like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Like, here's what I saw. We didn't have the internet, and now we're on Mars.
Yeah.
Dude, I bet. Like, we're probably 100 years away from being on different planets, honestly. Yeah. No, I think that shit's coming.
Do you want to know a crazy mathematical statistic? So there was a mathematician.
Is Dan Johnson qualified to be dropping mathematical statistics?
No, not at all. But I am qualified to regurgitate information I heard from somebody else.
Fair enough.
There's this mathematician out there, and he put all of the known particles that we know of in a repetitive order. Right. Basically saying a human is made up of these particles, a rock is made up of these particles, like all of these particles, right? And how they're aligned of what we know. And then he took the, what would be an estimated number of galaxies with an estimated number of suns, with an estimated number of planets from the observable known universe. Okay. Yeah. That the likelihood that everything starts to repeat itself in this known universe that we live in is very, very high. So he was talking about, for example, the likelihood of Dan Johnson having this same conversation on another planet somewhere out there is statistically a fact, basically. Right. So what I'm getting at is, who's going to be the first person to shoot a whitetail on a different planet? Like, that's the kind of shit that I think about when I'm falling asleep at night, or when I'm driving and my kids are talking and I'm not paying attention to them.
Right? Maybe that's why deja vu happens.
Maybe
we already had this conversation on a different planet 1,000 light years ago.
Yeah. That's crazy.
I think it's all simulation. How about that? I think we're in a computer, maybe.
And then are we going to wake up and then be unplugged like the Matrix and then live a different, like we've already chosen to, we've chose this life for ourselves, and that eventually we're going to start to die, and then we unplug ourselves just to be plugged into a new life that we have been, we chose to forget.
I don't think we chose anything. I don't think we chose to be here. I think there's a bigger power that maybe chose it, and we're in this computer, and one day it's just going to get unplugged.
That's deep, dude.
That's almost going away from like my religious beliefs. So I feel right. For saying, I feel like that's what the internet makes me feel like.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, you want to hear a crazy little internet thing that I saw? Like these people that were like, this conversation is crazy. we're all over the place. There was these people that were like doing like DMT. Are you familiar?
Yep.
Or at least kind of know.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know, like this frog juice or toad juice, whatever makes them like basically see the light and all these other things. And these people, I'm gonna botch this, but like they were on this, they were on like during this trip or this high, and like I don't know if they used like a barcode scanner or a laser of some sort and shined it at the wall, and they could see code while tripping balls on this stuff. They could see like computer code.
The Matrix.
I don't know. I mean, is this in a movie?
Have you seen
Did
the
I
Matrix?
Just repeat the Matrix.
Have you seen the Matrix?
I mean, probably 10 years ago. 15. No, I can't repeat like what happens in the movie. Is that what happens?
Well. Everything is code in the movie. That's what I'm saying is they are a computer program.
Somebody copied the Matrix and made an Instagram reel, made me feel like we're in a Matrix.
Dude, that's kind of crazy. Have you ever done mushrooms before?
No.
No, neither have I. I'm kind of past.
Love booze.
Yeah. I'm past, like I'm 1 year without alcohol. I haven't.
Good for
done,
you, man.
I've done some THC recently, yeah. Like a little gummy before bedtime, but I kind of want to do mushrooms just one time just to see what it's like, because I had a friend tell me it will change the way you look at life from the moment you do it to the rest of your life. It's going to change like how you look at life, how you look at decision making. Like he's like, here's reality, and mushrooms make you take one step to the right and look at reality in a different way.
What if it's a bad step? I kind of like my life right now. Like, I'm okay with it. Yeah, some bad shit happened to me, but all of a sudden, what if I just turn into some tree-hugging hippie that I didn't really want to be, you know? That'd be my fear. Like, all these people doing, like, this, not that I need it, but, like, you hear, like, these, like, soldiers using Ibogaine and, like, brain-altering DMT drugs, and, like, I don't know, man. Like, what if it changes me for the worse? You hear the good stories. What about the bad ones?
Yeah.
I'm just locking those guys in a closet somewhere, maybe.
Or, like, every time you chainsaw a tree, you can hear it scream. And then it just turns into like this nightmare for you.
Yeah, don't they say that's a thing? Like with like certain like, I don't know, microphones or certain technology, you can like hear plants. Like, I think that's a thing, dude. They're like living organisms. Somehow they communicate. I don't know. Like, the internet's just getting me. I don't know.
I think the internet's getting you, but I do feel like every living thing feels pain. I think it does in some way, shape or form.
Sure.
So. Like, if
things live and die, you think they'd feel pain.
Yeah, dude, I shot a button buck one time and it screamed and I was like, oh, dude, I felt horrible. I talked about this a while ago. Like, I felt really bad because it was like a spine shot and the back end just shut off, went down and his legs were stiff and he just sat there screaming, and I was like, oh my, I put another arrow in him real quick.
Okay, I was going to say, how did you dispatch the animal then? Use the second arrow.
Oh yeah, real quick. And then it was over.
See, I grew up with like, and I know you know these people too, it's like, yeah, don't waste the bullet, don't waste the arrow, like go walk up and take care of business.
Oh dude, I don't know.
One time I attempted to do that, and I got kicked so hard, and I almost shanked myself. I will never attempt to again.
With a knife.
Like, I just thought that's what you did. Like, that's what I was told by the elders, the people at deer camp.
Oh,
I just walk up and finish them off. I'm like, I almost stabbed myself to death.
Yeah. Well, lessons learned, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. Great conversation, though. We kind of ended it in a very weird place, but at least we talked about what you're good at and what you do and what you actually know a lot about today, which is which is a benefit. And maybe someday we will put a Noah's Ark type of space vessel together with all white-tailed deer on it. And just imagine there's a exoplanet out there with just the perfect terrain, with the perfect soil, perfect, like, oh, dude. And people just, they travel there to hunt. the new 300-inch typical whitetail.
I was going to say 300 inches behind every tree.
Every wild deer there has all the genetic superiority of like a Texas high fence, like mutated buck.
Yeah, with our technology, I give it like 10 to 15 years. We'll be there.
Awesome. Awesome. Can't wait. Well, Brett, man, I really appreciate your time. If people want to find out more about what you do, where should we send them?
Whitetail Land Management Services, Instagram, Facebook, Google, you'll probably find our website, but I don't really do much on the website anymore. Just find our social media and we'll get back with you.